Reporting is hard. Often, the things you want to find out, people don't want you to know. Sometimes, they lie or spin. Sometimes, they're agents of hostile authoritarian regimes where the price for speaking out of turn is very high.
The damning findings say the Russian President Vladimir Putin himself probably approved of Alexander Litvinenko's murder because of a long personal feud.
Former Russian Press Minister Mikhail Lessin was found dead at the DuPont Circle Hotel in Washington, D.C. 4 months ago.
One of two Russians Britain has charged with the attempted murder of former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in March, using a nerve agent called...
Shadowy is an adjective often invoked for this kind of activity, and it's a good one. So a recent story by the New York Times' Michael Schwartz kind of caught our eye. He's spent years on the trail of people who kill other people for the benefit of Vladimir Putin, as shadowy a world as there is. But when he located one such agent in a Ukrainian courtroom, everything that happened thereafter was altogether unexpected. Mike, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
Your story is about this small-time racketeer named Oleg Smorodinov, who had been recruited by Russian intelligence as an assassin. He was charged with gunning down some obscure Ukrainian electrician named Ivan Mamchur. But you weren't in Rivne, Ukraine, on the murdered electrician beat. What were you investigating?
I had come to Ukraine just in general looking into assassinations carried out by Russia. The world had been riveted by the recent poisoning of a former Russian spy named Sergei Skripal in the UK, and I wanted to dig more into this phenomenon. This was clearly not an isolated incident. There had been other assassinations going back years. You know, this is a practice that stretches back into the Cold War, back in the Soviet Union, to Stalin's time, to Lenin's time. And so I wanted to dig into sort of the modern iteration of this practice by Russia. And Ukraine is a good place to do that because Ukraine very often is a testing ground for all manner of Russian policies that then get exported to other countries, election meddling being one of them. And so I went to Ukraine and started asking around about the various assassinations that have been reported in the news and not reported in the news in recent years, stretching back to 2014 when a war started between Ukraine and separatist forces backed by Russia in the east of the country. And I'd done some research on a number of these assassinations and came across this one that just didn't seem to fit with the pattern of all the others.
Now, ordinarily, foreign press can't just walk up to murder suspects. And ordinarily, accused murderers don't immediately confess. But you just breeze in and approach Smorodinov, and he's like, killed the guy? Oh, yeah, I totally killed the guy. And by the way, the Russian government hired me to do it. Holy hell, Mike. Can you describe how this took place?
Well, I went to Rivne, which is a small town in western Ukraine with very, very low hopes of anything. And a number of surprising things happened when I arrived. One, they let me in the courtroom. And then when I approached Oleg, who was put into a cage that they have in the courtroom, it amazed me that he very almost immediately started just telling me the whole tale, and only the sort of judge entering the courtroom stopped him from talking, at which point he said that, why don't I come and visit him in the jail where he's being held, where he has tons of time and nothing much to do.
And it was a ghastly and kind of colorful tale he told, sort of a downmarket John Le Carré. Tell me what he told you.
He almost immediately confessed to pulling the trigger. He said that he had met with two individuals he believed to be Russian intelligence agents at a cafe in Moscow not far from the headquarters of the FSB, the Federal Security Service, which is Russia's internal domestic intelligence organization, and that they had told him that there were these individuals in Ukraine that they wanted to keep an eye on, this one individual in Rivne in particular. They sent him to this town. He rented an apartment. And in his telling, when he originally got there, he thought that his job was simply to surveil this individual, a claim belied by the fact that he was armed and had two weapons in his possession at the time that he was conducting this surveillance. And he did this for about a month and a half, watching this this electrician, Ivan Mamchur, go about his daily routine, taking his bicycle to work, coming home in the evening. And at one point in September 2016, he received a text message from his handlers in Moscow, a very cryptic text message which said, "The rose has to be picked today. Tomorrow it will no longer be relevant." And rose in this case referred to the victim who was given rose as a code name, at which point Oleg took his weapon, positioned himself outside Ivan's apartment and waited for him to arrive. And when he did and stepped out of the elevator, he called his name. Ivan turned, and then Oleg fired 8 shots into Ivan's body. Ivan turned toward him and staggered and said, "It wasn't me. I'm not guilty." And then he fell to the floor.
Now, Smorodinov was a thug, but not a trained spy or a button man. How exactly did he wind up outside of a Ukraine apartment shooting a total stranger? Who were these handlers?
Unfortunately, we only have Oleg's side of the story. Getting in touch with these handlers proved impossible. He only had their first names, Maxim and Philippe. But the way he described it, you have to go back a little bit to dig a little bit into Oleg's past. Oleg is an ethnic Russian. He was born in Central Russia and moved to Eastern Ukraine in what was then the Soviet Union when he was a teenager. And when war broke out in 2014, he threw his allegiance behind separatists who were taking control of large swaths of Eastern Ukraine with the help of the Russians. At some point, he got wounded in the fighting with Ukrainian forces and went to Moscow, where he linked up with individuals involved in what he described as weapons expos. And that is where he said he hooked up with people connected with Russia's intelligence services. And in his telling, he says he was looking simply after his pension. He was getting older. He was worried about his retirement. He wanted a job.
All right. So Mamchur is dead, and your man flies to Moscow for a victory lap. What happened there?
His handlers, in fact, took him to a Japanese sushi chain called Two Chopsticks, where they praised his performance. This is, again, all in Oleg's telling. They gave him a bit of money, though not the full amount that they had promised, because they said he'd left the weapons behind in Ukraine. But they also gave him a Mercedes van, pictures of which he posted to his various social media accounts. So this was his reward, and this is, he said he was perfectly willing, despite having killed a man, to continue working for these individuals and to continue doing their bidding. But he made a major mistake. He had planned to go back into Ukraine a few months after the killing to surprise an ex-girlfriend who very much did not want to see him. And it turns out that she had tipped off police well in advance of his arrival in the country that he had been in Rivne and that he had been looking to target what she described as enemies of Russia.
Of course, he confessed the entire scheme to his ex-girlfriend in the middle of it. And of course, he left just all kinds of physical evidence behind, including his own DNA. It was not the perfect crime.
Certainly not for him. He was arrested almost as soon as he crossed the border and taken back to Rivne and put in jail, and that's where he remains.
Now, as you were discussing, the political context role of this is the ongoing Russian interference in Ukraine, which culminated in the annexation of Crimea. At any given moment, it is a smoldering real war, but one in which one side denies being involved. You might think then that the victim in this case was caught up in that trauma, but it turns out, no, not that trauma.
Exactly. And the Ukrainian officials believe that this was related to the war in eastern Ukraine when they initially started investigating it. And I spoke to police officials locally and nationally, and they describe initially being baffled by this. They certainly did not think that it had anything to do with another war entirely, one in 2008 between the Republic of Georgia, which is another former Soviet republic, and Russia.
The accused spoke to you about a list of targets, 6 in all. One of them was the rose, who he ended up shooting to death. And the other five sounded like a flower shop order. And it led you to that previous Russian territorial adventure in Georgia. And you started trying to figure out who these people were who were listed there, and you began to see a pattern forming.
Right. It turned out that, first of all, each one of these individuals had a military background, and all of them seemed to have been retired by the time this murder took place. But what really connected them was that each seemed to have been connected in some way to the war in Georgia in 2008, a war in which Russia crushed the Georgian military, but also lost a number of planes due to sophisticated anti-aircraft defense systems that Russia had not anticipated.
In 2008, when Putin ran this blitzkrieg into Georgia and encountered this defense hardware he wasn't expecting, he wasn't happy about it. And he blamed Ukraine. Why?
He blamed Ukraine because Ukraine secretly sold these sophisticated weapon systems to Georgia in the years before the war. And Russia never believed that Georgian military specialists had the capacity to run these sophisticated systems. Putin specifically believed and said that the Ukrainians were involved in assisting the Georgians in the war. And to this, for him, it was a great treachery.
It is probably not safe to have Vladimir Putin angry with you because he's homicidal and, as it turns out, extremely patient.
Yeah, and this is one of a number of examples we can see of Putin sort of patiently waiting to get his revenge. And obviously, it's very hard to draw a direct line between any particular case and the Kremlin. This case in particular, because it is such a low-level murder. But what we do know is that Putin is very open when he gets angry, and people that he gets angry with very often come to bad ends.
These assassins turn out to be pretty good at killing the Kremlin's enemies, but they seem really bad at covering their tracks. The Skripal killers, for example, had maybe the worst alibi ever.
This was an incredible continuation of this story. We had been investigating this story for months, and all of a sudden the British government comes out and identifies two individuals that said were responsible for the poisoning. They identified them by aliases that they used on passports to get into the UK, and said they were officers with the GRU, which is Russia's military intelligence service. Within days, these two pop up on Russian TV claiming that they were tourists, sports nutritionists, who had visited Salisbury, which is where the poisoning took place, to take in its historic cathedral. And there was a sort of a strong insinuation in a country where there are laws against talking about homosexuality in areas that children might be listening. There was a strong insinuation that these two were a couple kind of on this vacation.
Which makes me wonder whether Putin actually wants the Kremlin's fingerprints on these killings to intimidate the people in his circle and just remind them of the penalty for betrayal. Could this be some game of three-dimensional chess, or is the GRU just like the gang that couldn't poison straight?
I always hesitate to attribute a high degree of sophistication and pre-planning to these sorts of operations. I think that there's a general idea of what they want the outcome to be, and it's a mixture of luck and circumstantial last-minute preparation. Knowledge of these operations doesn't harm the Kremlin's objectives. As I said, you know, very little in the way of a reaction has caused them to change their methods. I don't think that perhaps they wanted quite as many fingerprints on the Skripal poisoning as they achieved, but I do think it's certainly within the realm of possibility that they wanted the right people to know what had happened. I think it plays into sort of the Kremlin narrative of Russia as this sort of outcast, as this kind of bad kid on the block who has this ability to rankle the West.
Early on in the Trump presidency, the president was asked to explain why he's palling around with various authoritarian strongmen who do horrendous things. And his answer was something along the lines of, what, you think we haven't done this stuff too?
Putin's a killer. A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent?
He wasn't wrong. This story you wrote is appalling. But is it as peculiarly Russian as perhaps we'd like to believe?
That's a question. I think the Kremlin frequently points out that, you know, we're just doing what everybody else does. Maybe we do it a little more sloppily than other places and we get caught more, but we're doing the same thing to you that you're doing to us. The Kremlin particularly has this point when it comes to election interference. They issue their denials, but they also will come back and with this whataboutism and say, well, you started it. You know, you were interfering in our societal problems and our societal issues long before we were interfering in yours. Putin was livid at the suggestion that perhaps Hillary Clinton was behind or supportive of protests that were breaking out in Moscow in 2011 and 2012. And so I think in many ways they very much believe that they are just following the rule book set by the West.
And finally, the accused, Oleg Smorodinov, was he convicted?
Not yet, but it's pretty likely that he will be convicted. The trial is still going on. There's going to be another hearing this month. He's hoping that perhaps he might be traded for one of the many Ukrainian prisoners that are being held in Russia. He's sent some appeals on that front, and it doesn't seem that the Russians are all that interested as of now.
Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Schwartz is an investigative reporter with the New York Times based at the United Nations. His piece on the killing of the Rose is called Russia Ordered a Killing That Made No Sense, Then the Assassin Started Talking. That's it for this week's Pod Extra. Tune in for the big show on Friday, where we'll be talking about taxes, black holes, and a new documentary about Steve Bannon. I'm Bob Garfield. Talk to you then.
To kill.